pressed on. After one block, he glanced nervously behind him. To his dismay, the man in the baseball cap was no longer on the bench. He had crossed the street and was walking along the sidewalk behind Kirvish.
"He's following me."
The old rabbi's feet moved faster, and his breath grew short. He wondered if leaving his home had been a terrible mistake.
"Valdespino urged me to stay inside. Whom have I decided to trust?"
Kirvish had planned to wait for Valdespino's men to come and escort him to Madrid, but the phone call had changed everything. The dark seeds of doubt were sprouting quickly. The woman on the phone had warned him,
"The bishop is sending men not to transport you, but rather to remove you, just like he removed Sayed al-Fadl."
Then she had presented evidence so persuasive that Kirvish had panicked and fled. Now, as he hurried along the sidewalk, Kirvish feared he might not reach the safety of his synagogue after all. The man in the baseball cap was still behind him, tailing Kirvish at about 50 meters. A deafening screech tore through the night air, and Kirvish jumped. The sound, he realized with relief, was a city bus braking at a bus stop just down the block. Kirvish felt as if it had been sent by God himself as he rushed toward the vehicle and scrambled aboard. The bus was packed with raucous college students, and two of them politely made room for Kirvish in front.
"Gosenom," the rabbi wheezed, breathless. "Thank you."
Before the bus could pull away, however, the man in the jeans and baseball cap sprinted up behind the bus and narrowly managed to climb aboard. Kirvish went rigid, but the man walked past him without a glance and took a seat in the back. In the reflection of the windshield, the rabbi could see that the man had returned to his smartphone, apparently engrossed in some sort of video game.
"Don't be paranoid, Yehuda," he chided himself. "He has no interest in you."
When the bus arrived at the Dohany Street stop, Kirvish gazed longingly at the spires of the synagogue only a few blocks away, and yet he could not bring himself to leave the safety of the crowded bus.
"If I get out, and the man follows me..."
Kirvish remained in his seat, deciding he was probably safer in a crowd.
"I can just ride the bus for a while and catch my breath," he thought,
although he now wished he had used the toilet before fleeing his home so abruptly. It was only moments later, as the bus pulled away from Dohany Street, that Rabbi Kirvish realized the terrible flaw in his plan. "It's Saturday night, and the passengers are all kids." Kirvish now realized that everyone on this bus would almost certainly get off in the exact same place, one stop away, in the heart of Budapest's Jewish quarter. After World War II, this neighborhood had been left in ruins, but the decaying structures were now the hub of one of Europe's most vibrant bar scenes, the famous ruin bars, trendy nightclubs housed in dilapidated buildings. On weekends, throngs of students and tourists gathered here to party in the bombed-out skeletons of graffiti-covered warehouses and old mansions, now retooled with the latest sound systems, colorful lighting, and eclectic art. Sure enough, when the bus screeched to its next stop, all of the students piled out together. The man in the cap remained seated in the back, still engrossed in his phone. Instinct told Kirvish to get out as fast as he could, and so he clambered to his feet, hurried down the aisle, and descended into the crowd of students on the street. The bus revved up to pull away, but then suddenly halted, its door hissing open to release one final passenger, the man in the baseball cap. Kirvish felt his pulse skyrocket once again, and yet the man did not glance even once at Kirvish. Instead, he turned his back to the crowd and walked briskly in the other direction, placing a phone call as he went.
"Stop imagining things," Kirvish told himself, trying to breathe calmly.
The bus departed, and the pack of students immediately began moving down the street toward the bars. For safety, Rabbi Kirvish would stay with them as long as possible, eventually making a sharp left and walking back toward the synagogue.
"It's only a few blocks," he told himself, ignoring the heaviness of his legs and the increasing pressure in his bladder.
The ruined bars were packed, their boisterous clientele spilling out into the streets. All around Kirvish, the sounds of electronic music throbbed, and the tang of beer permeated the air, mixing with the sweet fumes of Sopiane cigarettes and Kurtoskalac chimney cakes. As he neared the corner, Kirvish still had the eerie sense he was being watched. He slowed down and stole one more glance behind him. Thankfully, the man in the jeans and baseball cap was nowhere to be seen. In a darkened entryway, the crouched silhouette remained motionless for 10 long seconds before carefully peering out of the shadows toward the corner. "Nice try, old man," he thought, knowing he had ducked out of sight just in time. The man double-checked the syringe in his pocket, then he stepped from the shadows, adjusted his baseball cap, and hurried after his mark.
Chapter 41 Guardia Commander Diego Garza sprinted back up toward the residential apartments, still clutching Monica Martin's computer tablet. The tablet contained a recording of a phone call, a conversation between a Hungarian rabbi named Yehuda Kirvish and some kind of online whistleblower, and the shocking contents of the recording had left Commander Garza precious few options. Whether or not Valdespino was actually behind the murderous conspiracy alleged by this whistleblower, Garza knew that when the recording went public, Valdespino's reputation would be forever destroyed.
"I must warn the prince and insulate him from the fallout. Valdespino must be removed from the palace before this story breaks."
In politics, perception was everything, and the information mongers, justly or not, were about to throw Valdespino under the bus. Clearly, the crown prince could not be seen anywhere near the bishop tonight. PR coordinator Monica Martin had strongly advised Garza to have the prince make a statement immediately, or risk looking complicit.
"She's right," Garza knew. "We have to get Julian on television. Now."
Garza reached the top of the stairs and moved breathlessly along the corridor toward Julian's apartment, glancing down at the tablet in his hand. In addition to the image of the Francoist tattoo and the recording of the rabbi's phone call, the impending ConspiracyNet data dump was apparently going to include a third and final revelation, something that Martin warned would be the most inflammatory of all. A data constellation, she had called it, describing what amounted to a collection of seemingly random and disparate data points, or factoids, that conspiracy theorists were encouraged to analyze and connect in meaningful ways to create possible constellations.
"They're no better than zodiac nuts," he fumed, "fabricating animal shapes out of the random arrangements of stars."
Unfortunately, the ConspiracyNet data points that were displayed on the tablet in Garza's hand appeared to have been especially formulated to coalesce into a single constellation, and from the palace's viewpoint, it was not a pretty one. ConspiracyNet.com The Kirsch Assassination, What We Know So Far. Edmund Kirsch shared his scientific discovery with three religious leaders, Bishop Antonio Valdespino, Alama Sayed Al-Fadl, and Rabbi Yehuda Kirvish. Kirsch and Al-Fadl are both dead, and Rabbi Yehuda Kirvish is no longer answering his home phone and appears to have gone missing. Bishop Valdespino is alive and well, and was last seen walking across the plaza toward the royal palace. Kirsch's assassin, identified as Navy Admiral Luis Avila, has body markings that tie him to a faction of ultra-conservative Francoists. Is Bishop Valdespino a known conservative, a Francoist as well? And finally, according to sources inside the Guggenheim, the events guest list was locked,
And yet, assassin Luis Avila was added at the last minute per the request of someone inside the royal palace. The individual on site who fulfilled that request was future queen consort Ambra Vidal. ConspiracyNet would like to acknowledge the substantial ongoing contributions of civilian watchdog Monte@Iglesia.org on this story.
Monte@Iglesia.org? Garza had already decided the email address had to be a fake. Iglesia.org was a prominent evangelical Catholic website in Spain, an online community of priests, laypeople, and students who were devoted to the teachings of Jesus. The informant seemed to have spoofed the domain so that the allegations would appear to come from Iglesia.org. Clever, Garza thought, knowing that Bishop Valdespino was deeply admired by the devout Catholics behind the site. Garza wondered if this online contributor was the same informant who had called the rabbi. As he reached the apartment door, Garza wondered how he would break the news to the prince. The day had started quite normally, and suddenly it seemed as if the palace was engaged in a war with ghosts. A faceless informant named Monte? An array of data points? Making matters even worse, Garza still had no news on the status of Ambra Vidal and Robert Langdon. God help us if the press learns of Ambra's defiant actions tonight. The commander entered without knocking.
Prince Julian, he called, hurrying toward the living room. I need to speak to you alone for a moment.
Garza reached the living room and stopped short. The room was empty.
Don Julian, he called,
wheeling back toward the kitchen.
Bishop Valdespino?
Garza searched the entire apartment, but the prince and Valdespino were gone. He immediately called the prince's cell phone and was startled to hear a telephone ringing. The sound was faint but audible, somewhere in the apartment. Garza called the prince again and listened for the muffled ringing, this time tracking the sound to a small painting on the wall, which he knew concealed the apartment's wall safe. Julian locked his phone in the safe? It was beyond belief to Garza that the prince would abandon his phone on a night when communication was so critical. And where did they go? Garza now tried Valdespino's cell number, hoping the bishop would answer. To his utter astonishment, a second muffled ringtone sounded inside the vault. Valdespino abandoned his phone as well? With rising panic, a wild-eyed Garza dashed out of the apartment. For the next several minutes, he ran down hallways, shouting, searching both upstairs and downstairs. They can't have evaporated into thin air. When Garza finally stopped running, he found himself standing breathless at the base of Sabatini's elegant grand staircase. He lowered his head in defeat. The tablet in his hands was asleep now. But in the blackened screen, he could see the reflection of the ceiling fresco directly overhead. The irony felt cruel. The fresco was Giacinto's grand masterpiece. Religion protected by Spain.
Chapter 42. As the Gulfstream G550 jet climbed to cruising altitude, Robert Langdon stared blankly out the oval window and tried to gather his thoughts. The past 2 hours had been a whirlwind of emotions, from the thrill of watching Edmund's presentation begin to unfold, to the gut-wrenching horror of seeing his grisly murder. And the mystery of Edmund's presentation seemed only to deepen, the more Langdon considered it. What secret had Edmund unveiled? Where do we come from? Where are we going? Edmund's words in the spiral sculpture earlier tonight replayed in Langdon's mind. Robert, the discovery I've made, it very clearly answers both of these questions. Edmund had claimed to have solved
two of life's greatest mysteries. And yet, Langdon wondered, how could Edmund's news have been so dangerously disruptive that someone would have murdered him to keep it silent? All Langdon knew for sure was that Edmund was referring to human origin and human destiny. What shocking origin did Edmund uncover? What mysterious destiny? Edmund had appeared optimistic and upbeat about the future, so it seemed unlikely that his prediction was something apocalyptic. Then what could Edmund possibly have predicted that would concern the clerics so deeply?
Robert, Umbra materialized next to him with a hot cup of coffee. You said black?
Perfect, yes. Thank you. Langdon gratefully accepted the mug, hoping some caffeine might help unknot his tangled thoughts. Umbra took a seat opposite him and poured herself a glass of red wine from an elegantly embossed bottle.
Edmund carries a stash of Chateau Montrose aboard. Seems a pity to waste it.
Langdon had tasted Montrose only once, in an ancient secret wine cellar beneath Trinity College, Dublin, while he was there researching the illuminated manuscript known as the Book of Kells. Umbra cradled her wine goblet in two hands, and as she brought it to her lips, she gazed up at Langdon over the rim. Once again, he found himself strangely disarmed by the woman's natural elegance.
"I've been thinking," she said. "You mentioned earlier that Edmund was in Boston and asked you about various creation stories?"
"Yes, about a year ago. He was interested in the different ways that major religions answered the question, where do we come from?"
"So maybe that's a good place for us to start," she said. "Maybe we can unravel what he was working on."
"I'm all for starting at the beginning," Langdon replied, "but I'm not sure what there is to unravel. There are only two schools of thought on where we came from. The religious notion that God created humans fully formed, and the Darwinian model in which we crawled out of the primordial ooze and eventually evolved into humans."
"So what if Edmund discovered a third possibility?"
Umbra asked, her brown eyes flashing.
"What if that's part of his discovery? What if he has proven that the human species came neither from Adam and Eve nor from Darwinian evolution?"
Langdon had to admit that such a discovery, an alternative story of human origin, would be earth-shattering, but he simply could not imagine what it might be. "Darwin's theory of evolution is extremely well established," he said, "because it is based on scientifically observable fact and clearly illustrates how organisms evolve and adapt to their environments over time. The theory of evolution is universally accepted by the sharpest minds in science."
"Is it?" Umbra said. "I've seen books that argue Darwin was entirely wrong."
"What she says is true," Winston chimed in from the phone, which was recharging on the table between them. "More than 50 titles were published over the past 2 decades alone." Langdon had forgotten Winston was still with them. "Some of these books were bestsellers," Winston added. "What Darwin Got Wrong, Defeating Darwinism, Darwin's Black Box, Darwin on Trial, The Dark Side of Charles Darwin." "Yes," Langdon interrupted, fully aware of the substantial collection of books claiming to disprove Darwin. "I actually read two of them a while back."
"And?" Umbra pressed.
Langdon smiled politely. "Well, I can't speak for all of them, but the two I read argued from a fundamentally Christian viewpoint. One went so far as to suggest that the Earth's fossil record was placed there by God in order to test our faith." Umbra frowned.
"Okay, so they didn't sway your thinking?"
"No, but they made me curious, and so I asked a Harvard biology professor for his opinion of the books." Langdon smiled. The professor, by the way, happened to be the late Stephen Jay Gould.
"Why do I know that name?"
Umbra asked. "Stephen Jay Gould," Winston said at once. "Renowned evolutionary biologist and paleontologist.
His theory of punctuated equilibrium explained some of the gaps in the fossil record and helped support Darwin's model of evolution.
Gould just chuckled, Langdon said, and told me that most of the anti-Darwin books were published by the likes of the Institute for Creation Research, an organization that, according to its own informational materials, views the Bible as an infallible literal account of historical and scientific fact.
Meaning, Winston said, they believe that burning bushes can speak, that Noah fit every living species onto a single boat, and that people turn into pillars of salt. Not the firmest of footings for a scientific research company.
True, Langdon said, and yet there are some non-religious books that attempt to discredit Darwin from a historical standpoint, accusing him of stealing his theory from the French naturalist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, who first proposed that organisms transformed themselves in response to their environment.
That line of thought is irrelevant, Professor, Winston said. Whether or not Darwin was guilty of plagiarism has no bearing on the veracity of his evolutionary theory.
I can't argue with that, Umbra said. And so, Robert, I assume if you asked Professor Gould, where do we come from, he would reply without a doubt that we evolved from apes.
Langdon nodded. I'm paraphrasing here, but Gould essentially assured me that there was no question whatsoever among real scientists that evolution is happening. Empirically, we can observe the process. The better questions, he believed, were, why is evolution happening, and how did it all start?
Did he offer any answers? Umbra said.
None that I could understand, but he did illustrate his point with a thought experiment. It's called the infinite hallway.
Langdon paused, taking another sip of coffee.
Yes, a helpful illustration, Winston chimed in before Langdon could speak. It goes like this. Imagine yourself walking down a long hallway, a corridor so long that it's impossible to see where you came from or where you're going.
Langdon nodded, impressed by the breadth of Winston's knowledge.
Then, behind you in the distance, Winston continued, you hear the sound of a bouncing ball. Sure enough, when you turn, you see a ball bouncing toward you. It is bouncing closer and closer until it finally bounces past you and just keeps going, bouncing into the distance and out of sight.
Correct, Langdon said. The question is not, is the ball bouncing? Because clearly the ball is bouncing. We can observe it. The question is, why is it bouncing? How did it start bouncing? Did someone kick it? Is it a special ball that simply enjoys bouncing? Are the laws of physics in this hallway such that the ball has no choice but to bounce forever?
Gould's point being, Winston concluded, that just as with evolution, we cannot see far enough into the past to know how the process began.
Exactly, Langdon said. All we can do is observe that it is happening.
This was similar, of course, Winston said, to the challenge of understanding the Big Bang. Cosmologists have devised elegant formulas to describe the expanding universe for any given time, T, in the past or future. However, when they try to look back to the instant when the Big Bang occurred, where T equals zero, the mathematics all goes mad, describing what seems to be a mystical speck of infinite heat and infinite density.
Langdon and Umbra looked at each other, impressed.
Correct again, Langdon said. And because the human mind is not equipped to handle infinity very well, most scientists now discuss the universe only in terms of moments after the Big Bang, where T is greater than zero, which ensures that the mathematical does not turn mystical.
One of Langdon's Harvard colleagues, a solemn physics professor, had become so fed up with philosophy majors attending his Origins of the Universe seminar that he finally posted a sign on his classroom door. In my classroom, T is greater than zero. For all inquiries where T equals zero, please visit the religion department.
How about panspermia?
Winston asked. The notion that life on Earth was seeded from another planet by a meteor or cosmic dust. Panspermia is considered a scientifically valid possibility to explain the existence of life on Earth.
Even if it's true, Langdon offered, it doesn't answer how life first began in the universe. We're just kicking the can down the road, ignoring the origin of the bouncing ball, and postponing the big question. Where does life come from?
Winston fell silent. Umbra sipped her wine, looking amused by their interplay. As the Gulfstream G550 reached altitude and leveled off, Langdon found himself imagining what it would mean to the world if Edmund truly had found the answer to the age-old question, where do we come from? And yet, according to Edmund, that answer was only part of the secret. Whatever the truth might be, Edmund had protected the details of his discovery with a formidable password, a single 47-letter line of poetry. If all went according to plan, Langdon and Umbra would soon uncover it inside Edmund's home in Barcelona.
Chapter 43. Nearly a decade after its inception, the dark web remains a mystery to the vast majority of online users. Inaccessible via traditional search engines, this sinister shadow land of the World Wide Web provides anonymous access to a mind-boggling menu of illegal goods and services. From its humble beginning hosting Silk Road, the first online black market to sell illegal drugs, the dark web blossomed into a massive network of illicit sites dealing in weapons, child pornography, political secrets, and even professionals for hire, including prostitutes, hackers, spies, terrorists, and assassins. Every week, the dark web hosted literally millions of transactions, and tonight, outside the ruined bars of Budapest, one of those transactions was about to be completed. The man in the baseball cap and blue jeans moved stealthily along Kaczynski Street, staying in the shadows as he tracked his prey. Missions like this one had become his bread and butter over the past few years and were always negotiated through a handful of popular networks: Unfriendly Solution, Hitman Network, and Besa Mafia. Assassination for hire was a billion-dollar industry and growing daily, due primarily to the dark web's guarantee of anonymous negotiations and untraceable payment via Bitcoin. Most hits involved insurance fraud, bad business partnerships, or turbulent marriages. But the rationale was never the concern of the person carrying out the job. No questions, the killer mused. That is the unspoken rule that makes my business work. Tonight's job was one he had accepted several days ago. His anonymous employer had offered him 150,000 euros for staking out the home of an old rabbi and remaining on call in case action needed to be taken. Action, in this case, meant breaking into the man's home and injecting him with potassium chloride, resulting in immediate death from an apparent heart attack. Tonight, unexpectedly, the rabbi had left his home in the middle of the night and taken a city bus to a seedy neighborhood. The assassin had tailed him and then used the encrypted overlay program on his smartphone to inform his employer of the development. Target has exited home, traveled to Bar District, possibly meeting someone? His employer's response was almost immediate. Execute. Now, among the ruined bars and dark alleyways, what had begun as a stakeout had become a deadly game of cat and mouse. Rabbi Yehuda Kirvish was sweating and out of breath as he made his way along Kaczynski Street. His lungs burned, and he felt as if his aging bladder were about to burst. All I need is a toilet and some rest, he thought, pausing among a crowd congregating outside Bar Simpla, one of Budapest's largest and most famous ruin bars.
The patrons here were such a diverse mix of ages and professions that nobody gave the old rabbi a second look.
"I'll stop, just for a moment," he decided, moving toward the bar.
Once a spectacular stone mansion with elegant balconies and tall windows, the Bar Simpler was now a dilapidated shell covered with graffiti. As Kirvish moved through the wide portico of this once grand city residence, he passed through a doorway inscribed with an encoded message. Eg Esh E Gedre. It took him a moment to realize that it was nothing but the phonetic spelling of the Hungarian word Egeshegedra, meaning cheers. Entering, Kirvish stared in disbelief at the bar's cavernous interior. The derelict mansion was built around a sprawling courtyard dotted with some of the strangest objects the rabbi had ever seen. A couch made from a bathtub, mannequins riding bicycles suspended in the air, and a gutted East German Trabant sedan, which now served as makeshift seating for patrons. The courtyard was enclosed by high walls adorned with a patchwork of spray-painted graffiti, Soviet-era posters, classical sculptures, and hanging plants that spilled over interior balconies packed with patrons who all swayed to the thumping music. The air smelled of cigarettes and beer. Young couples kissed passionately in plain sight, while others discreetly smoked from small pipes and drank shots of palinka, a popular fruit brandy bottled in Hungary. Kirvish always found it ironic that humans, despite being God's most sublime creation, were still just animals at the core, their behavior driven to a great extent by a quest for creature comforts. We comfort our physical bodies in hopes our souls will follow. Kirvish spent much of his time counseling those who overindulged in the animal temptations of the body, primarily food and sex, and with the rise of internet addiction and cheap designer drugs, his job had grown more challenging every day. The only creature comfort Kirvish needed at the moment was a restroom, and so he was dismayed to find a line 10 people deep. Unable to wait, he gingerly climbed the stairs where he was told he would find numerous other restrooms. On the second floor of the mansion, the rabbi moved through a labyrinth of adjoining sitting rooms and bedrooms, each with its own little bar or seating area. He asked one of the bartenders about a bathroom, and the man pointed to a hallway a good distance away, apparently accessible along a balcony walkway that overlooked the courtyard. Kirvish quickly made his way to the balcony, placing a steadying hand on the railing as he moved along it. As he walked, he peered absently into the bustling courtyard below, where a sea of young people gyrated in rhythm to the deep pulse of the music. Then Kirvish saw it. He stopped short, his blood turning cold. There, in the middle of the crowd, the man in the baseball cap and jeans was staring directly up at him. For one brief instant, the two men locked eyes. Then, with the speed of a panther, the man in the cap sprang into action, pushing his way past patrons and sprinting up the staircase. The assassin bounded up the stairs, scrutinizing every face he passed. Bar Simpler was quite familiar to him, and he quickly made his way to the balcony where his target had been standing. The rabbi was gone. "I did not pass you," the killer thought, "which means you moved deeper into the building." Raising his gaze to a darkened corridor ahead, the assassin smiled, suspecting he knew precisely where his mark would try to hide. The corridor was cramped and smelled of urine. At the far end was a warped wooden door. The killer padded loudly down the corridor and banged on the door. Silence. He knocked again. A deep voice inside grunted that the room was occupied. "Butcher son Meg," the killer apologized in a chirpy voice, and made a show of loudly moving away. Then he silently turned around and came back to the door, pressing his ear to the wood. Inside, he could hear the rabbi whispering desperately in Hungarian.
"Someone is trying to kill me. He was outside my house. Now he has trapped me inside Bar Simple in Budapest. Please, send help."
Apparently, his target had dialed 112, Budapest's equivalent of 911. Response times were notoriously slow, but nonetheless, the killer had heard enough. Glancing behind him to make sure he was alone, he leveled his muscular shoulder toward the door, leaned back, and synchronized his attack with the thunderous beat of the music. The old butterfly latch exploded on the first try. The door flew open. The killer stepped inside, closed the door behind him, and faced his prey. The man cowering in the corner looked as confused as he did terrified. The killer took the rabbi's phone, ended the call, and tossed the phone into the toilet.
Who sent you?
The rabbi stammered.
The beauty of my situation, the man replied, is that I have no way to know.
The old man was wheezing now, sweating profusely. He suddenly began to gasp, his eyes bulging out as he reached up and seized his own chest with both hands.
Really? The killer thought, smiling. He's having a heart attack?
On the bathroom floor, the old man writhed and choked, his eyes pleading for compassion as his face turned red and he clawed at his chest. Finally, he pitched face first onto the grimy tile, where he lay trembling and shuddering as his bladder emptied itself into his pants, a trickle of urine now running across the floor. Finally, the rabbi was still. The killer crouched down and listened for breathing. Not a sound. Then he stood up, smirking.
You made my job far easier than I anticipated.
With that, the killer strode toward the door. Rabbi Kurvish's lungs strained for air. He had just given the performance of a lifetime. Teetering near unconsciousness, he lay motionless and listened as his attacker's footsteps retreated across the bathroom floor. The door creaked open and then clicked closed. Silence. Kurvish forced himself to wait another couple of seconds to ensure that his attacker had walked down the hall out of earshot. Then, unable to wait another instant, Kurvish exhaled and began pulling in deep, life-giving breaths. Even the stale air of the bathroom tasted heaven-sent. Slowly, he opened his eyes, his vision hazy from lack of oxygen. As Kurvish raised his throbbing head, his vision began to clear. To his bewilderment, he saw a dark figure standing just inside the closed door. The man in the baseball cap was smiling down at him. Kurvish froze. He never left the room. The killer took two long strides to the rabbi, and with a vice-like grip, he grabbed the rabbi's neck and shoved his face back into the tile floor.
You could stop your breathing, snarled the killer, but you couldn't stop your heart.
He laughed.
Not to worry. I can help you with that.
An instant later, a searing point of heat tore into the side of Kurvish's neck. A molten fire seemed to flow down his throat and up over his skull. This time, when his heart ceased, he knew it was for real. After dedicating much of his life to the mysteries of Shamayim, the dwelling place of God and the righteous dead, Rabbi Yehuda Kurvish knew that all the answers were just a heartbeat away. Chapter 44. Alone in the spacious restroom of the G550 jet, Ambra Vidal stood at the sink and let warm water run gently over her hands as she stared into the mirror, barely recognizing herself in the reflection.
What have I done?
She took another sip of wine, longing for her old life of only a few months ago. anonymous, single, engrossed in her museum work. But all of that was gone now. It had evaporated the moment Julian proposed.
No, she chided herself. It evaporated the moment you said yes.
The horror of tonight's assassination had settled in her gut. And now her logical mind was fearfully weighing the implications. I invited Edmund's assassin to the museum. I was tricked by someone in the palace. And now I know too much.
There was no proof that Prince Julian was behind the bloody killing, nor that he was even aware of the assassination plan. Even so, Umbra had seen enough of the palace's inner workings to suspect that none of this could have happened without the prince's knowledge, if not his blessing.
I told Julian too much.
In recent weeks, Umbra had felt the growing need to justify every second she spent away from her jealous fiancé, and so she had privately shared with Julian much of what she knew about Edmund's upcoming presentation. Umbra now feared her openness might have been reckless. Umbra turned off the water and dried her hands, reaching for her wine goblet and draining the last few drops. In the mirror before her, she saw a stranger. A once confident professional, who was now filled with regret and shame.
The mistakes I've made in a few short months.
As her mind reeled back in time, she wondered what she could possibly have done differently. 4 months ago, on a rainy night in Madrid, Umbra was attending a fundraiser at the Reina Sofia Museum of Modern Art. Most of the guests had migrated to room 206.06 to view the museum's most famous work, El Guernica, a sprawling 25-foot-long Picasso that evoked the horrific bombing of a small Basque town during the Spanish Civil War. Umbra, however, found the painting too painful to view, a vivid reminder of the brutal oppression endured under Spain's fascistic dictator General Francisco Franco, between 1939 and 1975. Instead, she had chosen to slip alone into a quiet gallery to enjoy the work of one of her favorite Spanish artists, Maruja Mayo, a female surrealist from Galicia whose success in the 1930s had helped shatter the glass ceiling for female artists in Spain. Umbra was standing alone admiring La Verbena, a political satire filled with complex symbols, when a deep voice spoke behind her.
Es casi tan guapa como tú, the man declared. It's almost as beautiful as you are.
Seriously? Umbra stared straight ahead and resisted the urge to roll her eyes. At events like these, the museum sometimes felt more like an awkward pickup bar than a cultural center.
¿Qué crees que significa? The voice behind her pressed.
What do you think it means?
I have no idea, she lied, hoping that speaking English might make the man move on. I just like it.
I like it too, the man replied in almost accentless English. Mayo was ahead of her time. Sadly, for the untrained eye, this painting's superficial beauty can camouflage the deeper substance within. He paused. I imagine a woman like you must face that problem all the time.
Umbra groaned. Do lines like this really work on women? Affixing a polite smile to her face, she spun around to dispatch the man.
Sir, that's very kind of you to say, but...
Umbra Vidal froze mid-sentence. The man facing her was someone she had seen on television and in magazines for her entire life.
Oh, Umbra stammered. You're...
Presumptuous? The handsome man ventured. Clumsily bold? I'm sorry. I live a sheltered life, and I'm not very good at this sort of thing.
He smiled and extended a polite hand.
My name is Julian.
I think I know your name,
Umbra told him, blushing as she shook hands with Prince Julian, the future king of Spain. He was far taller than she had imagined, with soft eyes and a confident smile.
"I didn't know you were going to be here tonight," she continued, quickly regaining her composure. "I imagined you as more of a Prado man. You know, Goya, Velázquez, the classics."
"You mean conservative and old-fashioned," he laughed warmly. "I think you have me confused with my father. Mayo and Miró have always been favorites of mine."
Ambra and the prince talked for several minutes, and she was impressed by his knowledge of art. Then again, the man grew up in Madrid's royal palace, which possessed one of Spain's finest collections. He'd probably had an original El Greco hanging in his nursery.
"I realize this will seem forward," the prince said, presenting her with a gold-embossed business card. "But I would love for you to join me at a dinner party tomorrow night. My direct number is on the card. Just let me know."
"Dinner?" Ambra joked. "You don't even know my name."
"Ambra Vidal," he replied matter-of-factly. "You're 39 years old. You hold a degree in art history from the Universidad de Salamanca. You're the director of our Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao. You recently spoke out on the controversy surrounding Luis Quiles, whose artwork, I agree, graphically mirrors the horrors of modern life and may not be appropriate for young children. But I'm not sure I agree with you that his work resembles that of Banksy. You've never been married, you have no children, and you look fantastic in black."
Ambra's jaw dropped.
"My goodness. Does this approach really work?"
"I have no idea," he said with a smile. "I guess we'll find out."
As if on cue, two Guardia Real agents materialized and ushered the prince off to mingle with some VIPs. Ambra clutched the business card in her hand and felt something she had not felt in years. Butterflies. Did a prince just ask me for a date? Ambra had been a gangly teenager, and the boys who asked her out had always felt themselves to be on an equal footing with her. Later in life, though, when her beauty had blossomed, Ambra suddenly found men to be intimidated in her presence, fumbling and self-conscious and entirely too deferential. Tonight, however, a powerful man had boldly strode up to her and taken total control. It made her feel feminine and young. The very next night, a driver collected Ambra at her hotel and took her to the royal palace, where she found herself seated next to the prince in the company of 24 other guests, many of whom she recognized from the society pages or politics. The prince introduced her as his lovely new friend, and deftly launched a conversation about art in which Ambra could participate fully. She had the sensation that she was being auditioned somehow. But strangely, she didn't really mind. She felt flattered. At the evening's end, Julian took her aside and whispered,
"I hope you had fun. I'd love to see you again."
He smiled.
"How about Thursday night?"
"Thank you," Ambra replied, "but I'm afraid I'm flying back to Bilbao in the morning."
"Then I'll fly up as well," he said. "Have you been to the restaurant at Zenobi?"
Ambra had to laugh. At Zenobi was one of Bilbao's most coveted dining experiences. A favorite of art aficionados from around the world, the restaurant boasted an avant-garde decor and colorful cuisine that made diners feel as if they were seated in a landscape painted by Marc Chagall.
"That would be lovely," she heard herself say.
At Etzanobe, over stylishly presented plates of sumac-seared tuna and truffled asparagus, Julian opened up about the political challenges he faced as he attempted to emerge from the shadow of his ailing father, and also about the personal pressure he felt to continue the royal line. Ambra recognized in him the innocence of a cloistered little boy, but also saw the makings of a leader with a fervent passion for his country, She found it an alluring combination. That night, when Julian's security guards whisked him back to his private plane, Ambra knew she was smitten.
"You barely know him," she reminded herself. "Take it slow."
The next several months seemed to pass in an instant as Ambra and Julian saw each other constantly, dinners at the palace, picnics on the grounds of his country estate, even a movie matinee. Their rapport was unforced, and Ambra couldn't remember ever being happier. Julian was endearingly old-fashioned, often holding her hand or stealing a polite kiss, but never crossing the conventional boundaries, and Ambra appreciated his fine manners. One sunny morning, 3 weeks ago, Ambra was in Madrid, where she was scheduled to appear in a segment of a morning TV show about the Guggenheim's upcoming exhibits. RTVE's Telediario was watched by millions live around the country, and Ambra was a little apprehensive about doing live television. But she knew the spot would provide superb national coverage for the museum. The night before the show, she and Julian met for a deliciously casual dinner at Trattoria Malatesta, and then slipped quietly through El Parque del Retiro, watching the families out strolling and the scores of children laughing and running about. Ambra felt totally at peace, lost in the moment.
"Do you like children?" Julian asked.
"I adore them," she replied honestly. "In fact, sometimes I feel like children are the only thing missing in my life."
Julian smiled broadly.
"I know the feeling."
In that instant, the way he looked at her felt different somehow. And Ambra suddenly realized why Julian was asking the question. A surge of fear gripped her, and a voice in her head screamed out, tell him now. She tried to speak, but she couldn't make a sound.
"Are you okay?"
he asked, looking concerned. Ambra smiled.
"It's the Telediario show. I'm just a little nervous."
"Exhale. You'll be great."
Julian flashed her a broad smile and then leaned forward and gave her a quick, soft kiss on the lips. The next morning, at 7:30, Ambra found herself on a television soundstage, engaged in a surprisingly comfortable on-air chat with the three charming Telediario hosts. She was so caught up in her enthusiasm for the Guggenheim that she barely noticed the television cameras and the live studio audience, or remembered that 5 million people were watching at home.
"Gracias, Ambra, y muy interesante," said the female host as the segment concluded. "Un gran placer conocerte."
Ambra nodded her thanks and waited for the interview to end. Strangely, the female host gave her a coy smile and continued the segment by turning to address the home audience directly.
"This morning," she began in Spanish, "a very special guest has made a surprise visit to the Telediario studio, and we'd like to bring him out."
All three hosts stood up, clapping, as a tall, elegant man strode onto the set. When the audience saw him, they jumped to their feet, cheering wildly. Ambra stood too, staring in shock.
"Julian?"
Prince Julian waved to the crowd and politely shook the hands of the three hosts. Then he walked over and stood beside Ambra, placing an arm around her.
"My father has always been a romantic," he said, speaking Spanish and looking directly into the camera to address the viewers. "When my mother died, he never stopped loving her. I inherited his romanticism, and I believe when a man finds love, he knows in an instant."
He looked at Ambra and smiled warmly.
"And so?"
Julian stepped back and faced her. When Ambra realized what was about to happen, she felt paralyzed with disbelief.
"No! Julian, what are you doing?"
Without warning, the Crown Prince of Spain was suddenly kneeling down before her.
"Ambra Vidal, I am asking you not as a prince,
but simply as a man in love. He looked up at her with misty eyes, and the cameras wheeled around to get a close-up of his face. I love you. Will you marry me? The audience and the show's hosts all gasped in joy, and Ambra could feel millions of eyes around the country focusing intently on her. Blood rushed to her face, and the lights felt suddenly scalding hot on her skin. Her heart began to pound wildly as she stared down at Julian, a thousand thoughts racing through her head. How could you put me in this position? We've only recently met. There are things I haven't told you about myself, things that could change everything. Ambra had no idea how long she had stood in silent panic, but finally one of the hosts gave an awkward laugh and said, I believe Ms. Vidal is in a trance. Ms. Vidal? A handsome prince is kneeling before you and professing his love before the entire world. Ambra searched her mind for some graceful way out. All she heard was silence, and she knew she was trapped. There was only one way this public moment could end.
I'm hesitating because I can't believe this fairy tale has a happy ending.
She relaxed her shoulders and smiled warmly down at Julian.
Of course I will marry you, Prince Julian.
The studio erupted in wild applause. Julian stood up and took Ambra in his arms. As they embraced, she realized that they had never shared a long hug before this moment. 10 minutes later, the two were sitting in the back of his limousine.
I can see I startled you, Julian said. I'm sorry I was trying to be romantic. I have strong feelings for you, and—
Julian, Ambra interrupted forcefully, I have strong feelings for you, too. But you put me in an impossible position back there. I never imagined you would propose so quickly. You and I barely know each other. There are so many things I need to tell you, important things about my past.
Nothing in your past matters.
This might matter a lot.
He smiled and shook his head.
I love you. It won't matter.
Try me.
Ambra studied the man before her. Okay, then. This was most certainly not how she had wanted this conversation to go, but he had given her no choice.
Well, here it is, Julian. When I was a little girl, I had a terrible infection that almost killed me.
Okay.
As Ambra spoke, she felt a deep emptiness welling up inside her.
And the result was that my life's dream of having children, well, it can only be a dream.
I don't understand.
Julian, she said flatly, I can't have children. My childhood health problems left me infertile. I've always wanted children, but I am unable to have any of my own. I'm sorry. I know how important that is to you. But you've just proposed to a woman who cannot give you an heir.
Julian went white. Ambra locked eyes with him, willing him to speak.
Julian, this is the moment when you hold me close and tell me everything's okay. This is the moment you tell me it doesn't matter, and that you love me anyway. And then, it happened.
Julian shifted away from her, ever so slightly. In that instant, Ambra knew it was over. Chapter 45 The Guardia's Division of Electronic Security is located in a windowless warren of rooms on the subterranean level of the Royal Palace. Intentionally isolated from the palace's vast Guardia barracks and armory, the division's headquarters consists of a dozen computer cubicles, one telephone switchboard, and a wall of security monitors. The 8-person staff, all under the age of 35, is responsible for providing secure communication networks for the staff of the Royal Palace and the Guardia Real. as well as handling electronic surveillance support for the physical palace itself. Tonight, as always, the basement suite of rooms was stuffy, reeking of microwaved noodles and popcorn.